From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. It's easy to have an idealized vision of love and sex, but for every cheery Valentine, there's a broken heart. For that, there's the tango.
Just one or two isotopes is enough to change your life and enough to give you this yen that you have that can only be cured by going to the milongas, the tango word for dance halls.
Today, the dark side of love. We'll meet Lucia, the woman who stole Casanova's heart and never gave it back, and the secretive author behind one of erotica's most taboo books, Story of O.
There's something about that book. It has a very strong sense of personal freedom in it that really is arrived at through this complete giving over of oneself.
Sex industries are commonplace in many countries, but it may be surprising to learn that one of the oldest red light districts in the world is found in Pakistan, a Muslim country. It's called Hira Mandi, or Diamond Market. This is the place that Louise Brown has visited for years, getting to know the women and the culture of prostitution. She writes about her experience in a book, The Dancing Girls of Lahore. Brown told Anne Strainchamps that Hira Mandi has a rich culture that goes back thousands of years.
The culture is built not just simply around the sale of sex, but traditionally, prostitution in Pakistan, and indeed throughout the whole of the Indian subcontinent, has been associated with the performing arts. So that traditionally, the higher class of prostitutes were actually courtesans, and they were trained from a very young age, maybe from about 6 or 7, in singing and particularly in dancing. When the girls got to about 13, 14 or 15, they would then enter the business. They would sell sex, but they would also be providing cultural performances. So this goes back an awful long way. There's been a link between the performing arts and sex and prostitution within the subcontinent for hundreds, maybe even thousands of years.
And were those girls, was there kind of pride associated with what they did?
Most definitely. They saw themselves as artists. And in fact, they were artists. They were extremely highly trained.
But that's changed in recent years, hasn't it?
It certainly has. What's happened is that a lot of the elite prostitution is in the process of moving out from Hira Mandi. And what is left in Hira Mandi are women who sell sex, but with far less of the kind of cultural accompaniments to selling sex, so that very few will now be trained in singing and dancing. Maybe they will have a course that lasts for a few months rather than a training that will last for years.
Mm. One of the surprising things about Hira Mandi is the fact that this is in Pakistan, which is a largely Muslim country. Isn't that something of a contradiction?
It is in any respect, but all societies, well, most societies have sex industries. It just takes different forms. The interesting thing about Pakistan is that although prostitution is illegal, in fact, all sex outside marriage is illegal, there is still a flourishing sex trade. The authorities basically just turn a blind eye to it. Providing it's concentrated in a particular area, say for example in Hira Mandi, there is acceptance of prostitution, providing it is hidden and providing it can be sort of under the control of the local police and the authorities. Because basically the police are actively involved in the prostitution business because they take free sexual services from the women and also they take bribes and protection money.
You've spent years following the life of one particular prostitute there, Maha. Will you tell me something about her?
Maha is from a traditional family of courtesans, so that women in her family have been in prostitution and also in the performing arts for literally generations. So Maha's grandmother and great-grandmother before her have all been in the same kind of business. Maha is now in her early 40s, and so that she's no longer viable within the business because there's an emphasis placed upon beauty and upon youth. So what's happened is there's been a generational transition during the few years that I've been following Maha's story, in the sense that her daughters are now replacing her in the business, and Maha has withdrawn from the trade. She no longer sings or dances or sells sex, and instead she manages the careers of her daughters.
So she is the pimp for her daughters?
Yes. In practice, yes.
And that's the way it was for her. Her mother sold her into prostitution.
It's repeated over and over again. And it's not as if the women are making a free choice to put their daughters into prostitution. It's not as if they have anything else that they can do, because they're born into prostitution. They carry that stigma with them for the rest of their lives. They're seen as a kind of separate social group. Nobody will marry the daughter of a prostitute, even if that girl has never been in prostitution herself, because she's seen to be tainted by the stigma, that she's almost inherited the stigma from her mother.
You talked about they take pride in doing their job well. Do you mean just the singing and dancing, or their pride in their sexual abilities?
I think it's a mixture of both. They certainly take pride in being beautiful and well-presented and dancing well, but they also take pride in the fact that very high-status men would be interested in the daughters. So Maha's one daughter, Nena, who is now, she's an accomplished dancer. She's also patronised by a lot of very powerful men within Pakistan, because she's young and because she's beautiful and because she's talented. And that has also got to do with her sexual skills too.
How did they see their relationship with you? I mean, here you are. I mean, no longer a stranger, but somebody who shows up and lives with them in their house. Like, what, a relative from a distant place who's come to visit?
A little like a relative from a distant place, a very close friend. It's hard for me to say how they view me. I like to think that they see me as a close friend. The girls in Maha's family do treat me as if I'm an aunt and they confide in me. On the other hand, I can also see that, you know, my role as an outsider is a difficult one, because I am seen as a kind of almost like a window to another world. And it's also linked with status. Having friends from abroad is seen as being a sign of status for the women too. So I think that many times they see me as an asset, but also sometimes a little bit of a strange asset, in the sense that I don't always do things correctly. I don't always understand exactly what's going on. So there's a kind of ambivalence. I would like to think that they really like me. I certainly hope they do.
There are a lot of funny scenes in which they seem to be constantly worrying about your makeup.
I think
you don't look the way they want you to.
No, I definitely don't come up to the mark, really. Because there's so much emphasis on looking good, the girls will spend hours every day on their makeup and their hair and their clothes. And I don't do that, and it really does show. So whenever we're going out, they try to encourage me to put on some more makeup or to change my clothes.
Do you play with makeup with them and
I do,
let them
but
dress
I always,
you? And...
Yeah, but I tend to look really hideous because I'm very fair-skinned. And so when they apply the makeup they would normally put on themselves, it doesn't suit me because it's much darker and more dramatic, lots of red lipstick and black eyeliner, which I really don't look good. I think they're concerned about it.
It must put you in such an awkward position to be there and to be friends. I mean, don't you want to, especially the girls, haven't you wanted to save them?
I have, but I don't know how to save them, because it's not as if I could give them a completely new life. It's not as if I could find them a new job, if you like, a new way to support themselves, because they have very few skills apart from dancing and selling sex. There was a time when Nena, who was then at the time 14, was sent to Dubai for a marriage to a very important sheikh. And I was very concerned about this.
Marriage is probably the wrong word.
Yes. Well, it's a short-term liaison. Mm. And the marriage would last 2 or 3 days, and then she would be sent home.
And she was 14 and a virgin then?
Yes, yes. Virginity carries a very, very high price, because it's associated with power. Only powerful men can afford to buy the virginity of, you know, elite courtesans.
So this was her entrance into the trade. She was her virginity was being sold by her mother,
right,
by her family.
And that was is actually seen as something that was very positive by the family, because it was associated with high status. Because the sheikh himself was of extremely high status, and because he was paying a lot of money, the family were pleased. And it wasn't simply because of the money, it was because of the status of the man himself. It was almost as if his social capital was sort of rubbing off on Nena. She'd be seen as the virgin bride of this very important sheikh. And that would do their reputation in the brothel area an awful lot of good, because she would be associated with a high-status man.
And what were Nena's feelings? I mean, did she completely accept that this was how it should be? Did she have no fear, or was she also...
She
was 14.
She was frightened, but happy at the same time. She did go to Dubai, And actually, the marriage was not consummated. I use the word marriage rather loosely. The women commonly talk about clients as husbands and the sex that they have with them, they talk about it as a marriage. But this relationship wasn't consummated, and Nena was sent home after several months. Basically, she could not go through the process. She couldn't have sex with the sheikh because she was so upset. She kept being sick. And so the agent returned her to her mother a few months later.
What were the consequences for her then?
She was in disgrace, not in terms of, you know, her mother's opinion, but in terms of the system of agents that work in Hiramandi. Nena was known as a girl who caused trouble. So her status was, you know, lower, and many of the agents didn't deal with the family after that for a while. When Nena became a little bit older and she was more settled and she felt ready to enter the business, then her virginity was sold, if you like, that's a way of putting it, to another rich Arab, but nowhere near as high status as the original sheikh. And I found this whole process very, very difficult, because there was a time when I could have intervened to stop her being sent to Dubai. This is when she was 14, and I really didn't know what to do, because for the perspective of the family, it was a good thing. This is what the girls in the area have done for generations. And I saw it as my role not to intervene, but to document what was happening. By the same token, even if I had intervened to stop her being sent to Dubai, soon as I had gone back to England, she would then have gone. The only other alternative is to have her rescued by a charity. But that means that she then would have been deprived of the family that she loves, and she would have been placed in care, which in many respects is often worse than some of the places in Hiramandi.
What do you think will happen to this family ultimately? Because the world that they are moving in, this world of the higher class prostitution and the culture of Hiramandi, is also disappearing and changing radically.
It is. Prostitution is moving out of the red light area, but it's still very much associated with particular kinds of women, particular groups of women. Therefore, they might not live in Hiramandi in the future. They might, if they are successful enough, be able to buy a nice house in the suburbs, but they will still be linked with prostitution in the eyes of mainstream society, and that makes it very hard for them to integrate. They are seen as a kind of a group apart, and it's heavily stigmatized. So I've known of women who can escape from the brothel, but there are very, very few of them. A couple of instances of women who became famous actresses, and Hiramandi has, with its connections with the performing arts, been a place from which actresses and performers in Lollywood, it's the Pakistani equivalent of Bollywood, it's a place where these kind of women have come from. So some women who have been actresses have been able to get out of the brothel. There have also been a few instances of very high status women who have made established successful relationships, long-term relationships, with wealthy men and made enough money to be able to educate their own daughters. And then those daughters, providing they leave Pakistan, have been able to establish a new life away from prostitution. But I'm not aware of women who make it out of the brothel and still remain within Pakistan, within kind of mainstream respectable society.
Louise Brown is the author of The Dancing Girls of Lahore. She spoke with Anne Strangeships. Coming up, the sultry sadness of the tango.
If nostalgia was a country, tango is its capital.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Robert Ferris Thompson was smitten by the tango. It seduced him in the nightclubs of Buenos Aires, and he's been under its spell ever since. To Thompson, tango is about more than dance. It's a meditation on love, loss, and desire. Thompson writes about his obsession in the book Tango, The Art History of Love.
It's not just motion, baby. It's someone that you met and she changes your life. Most of the tango dancers are either lovers, or they should be, or they're married, or they're thinking of someone else. But whatever it is, there's definitely a rapprochement between Adam and Eve going on constantly in tango. I went to Buenos Aires in 1995, and this buddy of mine and his wife, they took me out to not just anywhere, they took me to Café Homero. And that would be comparable to French terms, as if someone had taken me to the Café de Magot when François Sagan was in her heyday and when Sartre was there sipping his little coffee. And so I was taken to this incredible coffee house slash nightclub, and there somehow I remember the lights were all blue. There's a lot of smoke. And Goyeneche came out. And Goyeneche is the Frank Sinatra of tango. And he stared at us intently. And out of his mouth came, La vida es una herida absurda. And I got goose pimples because that means life is an absurd wound. Polish me off, the great Nicole Nau Klapwijk from a famous Dutch-German dancing team. She was there that night. She's so gorgeous that to have a date with her, I almost give up my career. How do you get culturally prepared for this? Well, it was inevitable because when I was a kid growing up in El Paso, Texas, I crossed the border to watch Mexican movies, and they were in their heyday. This is in the 50s. And I kept seeing this striking, handsome woman, Libertad Lamarque, and I couldn't quite pick it up. My Spanish wasn't good enough yet. But gradually it dawned on me that her accent was different. It wasn't that, ora mano, que ven por acá mano, that wonderful, melodious Mexican accent. Instead, she would say, like, yo estoy tan cansada. And I'd hear this "j" sound in the yo, I am, etc. I realized, my God, she's an Argentine. Because she was one of the hottest numbers in Argentine film until 45 when Perón came in. And the story is that there was room for only one major star, woman star. Evita took over and she went into exile. Then as I got into jazz, I was eventually hip to the presence of this incredible guy who is to the tango what Charlie Parker was to jazz. And Charlie Parker's sax revolutionized jazz. And this man, Astor Piazzolla, his bandoneon, which is a key instrument of tango, he revolutionized the way we look at tango. There were almost 100 Argentine tango dancers in Paris just before World War I. And so the Parisians got the life. They saw them dance. They saw that cold face. They saw that completely controlled, fluid movement. And among the people who was blown away by this, by seeing a taste of the real tango life, even though it was in exile in Paris, was a young man by the name of Baron Megata. And Baron Megata was of the blood royal of Japan. He was distantly related to Hirohito. So here he was, and he fell in love with tango. When he got back to Tokyo, He and another comparably noble Japanese woman, the Duchess of Okama, because they were of the royal family or related, they felt it would be cheap for them to charge, so they taught tango free. And as a result, they imparted steps and a feeling for life through tango. Take Finland, the last country in the world, so blonde, so Scandinavian. And yet it is true, believe it or not, that tango was declared the national dance of Finland. Now, how can they absorb the Argentine lifestyle? Well, the truth is that they remake it as a Finnish thing. There's a lot of brooding in the music of Sibelius. Sibelius is one of my favorite composers. And if you listen to him, you see him culturally preparing the Finnish lovers of fine arts and sound for tango. And now, the impact is so strong that last summer, in the annual Tango Festival of Finland, 147,000 people showed up. That's a city, man. If you listen to it, you're not in Los Angeles anymore. You're not in Dubuque. You're in Buenos Aires and in Bijak Valmera, particularly when Eladia Vasquez says, if Buenos Aires, if you weren't there when I lift my Venetian blinds early in the morning, I would die. You know, that hits hard. Or Discepolo saying, when I was a kid, you taught me tango, cafe. I'd press my little nozzle against the glass, blue with cold, and look in. You taught me how to hold a cigarette, how to talk, how to rap to a girl, and so forth.
Si supiera que aún dentro de mi alma conservo aquel cariño que tuve para ti. Quién sabe si supieras que nunca te he olvidado, volviendo a tu pasado, te acordarás de mí.
Just one or two isotopes is enough to change your life and enough to give you this yen that you have that can only be cured by going to the milonga, the tango word for dance halls. If nostalgia was a country, tango is its capital. There's a saying, el tango siempre te espera, tango is always waiting for you, meaning it will test you with one of these life crises. But it is not only testing you, it is a solution, it is a medicine, it is a balm.
Robert Ferris Thompson is the author of Tango, The Art History of Love. Most of us try to forget our awkward attempts to explore our burgeoning sexuality, but not Paul Feig. Not only does Feig remember these embarrassing moments, he wrote them down and published them as a memoir. The book is called Superstud, or How I Became a 24-Year-Old Virgin. To the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon spoke with Paul Feig about the trials and tribulations of exploring his sexuality as a teen.
Paul Feig and I have a lot in common. True, I haven't created a critically acclaimed Emmy Award-nominated TV series, but hey, I'm sure I'll get around to it one of these days. Looking back, it's safe to say that both Feig and I were geeks in high school. And of course, geeks don't have the most robust romantic lives. Heck, some would say geeks don't even have lives, period. But one thing we geeks definitely do have is angst. Both Feig and I have struggled with guilt over masturbation. When he was 12, Feig went on a Caribbean vacation with his parents. They were in their hotel room listening to the radio when the disc jockey said something that really struck a chord with Feig.
Besides, everyone knows that every time you masturbate, God takes one day off of your life. my head, like all the blood drained out of my head. I was like, oh my God, everyone knows? Nobody told me. No, they didn't teach me that in Sunday school. I had no idea that that happened. And completely took that to heart and thought, this has to be true. And I kind of looked over and I saw my dad throw a look at my mom that, you know, probably meant he was, you know, saying, turn this superstitious crap off. But I took it as meaning, see, I told you a boy loses a day every time he masturbates. So it just sent me into this whole just kind of math I was doing of like, wait, how many days had I lost, you know, and kind of adding things up of like, well, all right, so I probably lost 2 years already, okay, but well, my grandmother lived to be pretty old, so I'll probably live to be 90, you know, so okay, so I can probably lose 5 years because I'll be senile then anyway, and it'll be kind of like a public service to the world to sort of euthanize myself by masturbating too much. But then all of a sudden I was going like, wait a minute, what if I'm only supposed to live till like I'm 20? So like the next time I do it, I could drop dead. So it was just went, okay, I gotta stop totally. And then thus began the major battle of my entire adolescence and puberty.
I can't fight this feeling any longer, and yet I'm still afraid to let it flow.
REO Speedwagon, or REO as the cool kids call them. Paul Feig took his trophy date, Jill Hallstetter, the girl with the biggest assets in school, to an REO Speedwagon concert at Cobo Hall in Detroit Rock City. Feig and Jill were sitting way up in the rafters. Then three guys in their early 20s sat down directly behind them.
And they just chat her up the entire time. I mean, they're just all over her, and just nobody's paying attention to me whatsoever. And she's talking to them, and the drunk guy's making jokes, and he's like, hey, who's your little brother? And it's like, I'm not your little brother. And the concert starts, and like, oh, I'll figure it out. And well, at least the concert's on. They won't bother us anymore. But then all through the concert, the guy keeps leaning over, and he's talking to her, and he's got his hands cupped over her ear and telling her stories, and she's laughing. And it's like, what? I paid for these tickets. Why are you talking to this guy? It's going on, and finally she kind of stops talking to them and leans forward to listen to the song, and I think, okay, well, finally I got her back. And the drunk guy leans forward and just throws up all down the back of her chair, just a real stomach emptier, like he just won a hot dog eating contest or something. And it's like, oh no. And then like I panic, and then she turns around, she sees it, so I'm just completely frozen with fear and not knowing what to do. The handsome guy like goes, oh my God, and he like grabs the drunk guy. He's like, Spencer, you idiot, you're gonna sit down there. And he like grabs Jill by the arm. He goes, and you're coming up here into his seat, and like pulls her up over the row, and then sticks him down in the vomit covered chair next to me. So now I got this drunk guy who passes out on my shoulder. I'm sitting next to vomit. My date is up with the handsome guy behind me. It's like, what do I do? And I'm just through the whole concert, and I was just frozen, because like I'm supposed to probably fight the guy or something, but he actually did act more chivalrous than I did at that moment. He solved the problem where I was just blinded by inaction. So at the end of the concert, you know, I was like, well, is the date still going on or not? And she goes, hey, guess what? These guys invited us to a party. It's like, oh no, this doesn't sound good. Well, maybe she still thinks it's a date. And she goes, you know what? You should come, because you can probably meet somebody. And it's like, oh God. So it was all over.
Paul Feig finally lost his virginity at the tender age of 24. No, I'm not going to tell you how it happened. Read the book.
Now, this may come as a surprise to you that I think I've actually got you beat by a couple of years, because I didn't lose my virginity until I was 26.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. Where's your book? Come on.
Like a virgin, touched for the very first time. Like a virgin, when your heart beats next to mine, gonna give you all my love, boy.
Longtime virgin Paul Feig is the author of Superstud. He spoke with TT Book producer Doug Gordon. For information about the music and books heard on To the Best of Our Knowledge, stop by our website. It's ttbook.org. Coming up, the life and times of Casanova's first love, Lucia. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. We'll be right back. Everyone's heard of Casanova, the Italian rogue who seduced hundreds of women. But how did Casanova become Casanova? And did a woman ever break his heart? These are the questions that intrigued Dutch novelist Arthur Japin. The result is the book In Lucia's Eyes. It tells the imagined story of Casanova's first love, a servant girl named Lucia.
This is an idea that came to me long, long, long ago, even before I started being a writer. It was, I think, 20 years ago when I, for the first time, went to Venice, and I took some books from the shelves, as you do, and amongst them were a couple of volumes of Giacomo Casanova's memoirs. He wrote his memoirs at a late age, and I think he takes almost 10,000 pages to write about all these wonderful adventures, all his wonderful love life, and the 121 women he has known all get their own story, usually with a heroic part for himself in it. And it struck me that only about the very first one, he is very brief, Lucia. She is the first great love of his life, and he is hers. And they meet in volume one, he speaks of how they meet. She lives in Passiano, an estate somewhat outside of Venice. She's 14, he's 17, and he comes to visit, and they see each other, and it's love at first sight. They've never experienced anything like it, and they don't think they ever will again. So they pledge each other to be eternally faithful, and they want to marry. They have a wonderful summer, but in October, Giacomo, he has this dilemma because he wants to make a career for himself in the diplomatic service. And for that, he has to go to Venice to show himself off at all the balls and be witty and look his best and make a good impression on the right people. And Giacomo keeps his word. He does come back in the spring at Easter. There he is at Passiano, but she's not there. Mm. And then two volumes later, he mentions her again, briefly, only three pages. And he's much older, and he travels as the Chevalier de St. Gall through Europe, and he comes to Amsterdam, and with a friend, as you do in Amsterdam, he goes to a brothel, and there she is, his Lucia, and he says, well, she must be around 30 now, but she looks like she's way over 50, and she's not just ugly, but she's become hideously deformed. And again, that's all he tells us, and when I read that, I was left with so many questions. I wanted to know why she gave up her big love of her life. I wanted to know how she came from Passiano to Amsterdam, how she became from being this simple peasant girl to being a whore, and what does that do to you? And most of all, how did she become so hideously deformed?
Tell me some of the truths that you have discovered about the Lucia you've created then. Who is this woman that Casanova fell in love with?
Well, the wonderful thing, that several things that once you're in love with this character, as you must be when you want to write from their point of view. Some of the wonderful stuff I found was, for instance, something I had never heard of. At a certain point, she gets a smallpox, just at the moment that Casanova wants to come back to Passiano. And she decides to flee. She decides to go away and let him have his career, which he could never have with a deformed woman by his side. And she flees to Bologna. That's one of the things I found. And at that time, Bologna was a wonderful place for women because the Pope in Rome was Bolognese. He came from Bologna and decided only to give money to this famous old university if they would allow women into the sciences. And that drew learned women from all over Europe. And Lucia ends up as the servant of one of those women. Now, that's where my information ends. But then it is so wonderful to imagine her being there and listening to the conversations and watching the experiments they were doing, that sort of brings the story along and gives you an idea of how she must have developed as a woman and how she finally ends up in Amsterdam. And then in Amsterdam, you pick up the thread again. Well, you know what the Dutch are like. We're very free about sexuality, and even in the 18th century. So everything about the prostitution is documented. We know every gesture. We know what was charged for what for what purpose. And there also the names of some of the women are mentioned, especially the ones that were put in the spin house, which was like a center, like a prison almost. Yeah. And that's where her name pops up again.
We could get a sense, perhaps, of Lucia and the development of her mind with a passage from the book. There's a section, it's near the end, but it is not so near the end that it would give anything away, that I wonder if you would read. It is about love.
For too many years, I confused love with desire. As a girl, I had seen people yearning. Some went out to hunt for love. Others stayed home, restlessly waiting for someone to come and offer it to them. People talked about it as if life itself depended upon it. Those without it needed to find it, and the sooner the better. Those who had enjoyed but lost it had no more urgent need than to replace it, if necessary by stealing the treasure someone else had laid away. To acquire wealth or fame was child's play compared with acquiring love. Even having a chunk of bread was less important, because love was well known to extinguish hunger. Lovers, I had thought, could withstand every deprivation for the sake of winning the prize they had set their hearts on, and no one was more praiseworthy than one who would lay down his life to win the love of another. And yet, for all the effort applied to its attainment, love was plainly something enjoyed only by a lucky few. All others were pitiable and self-pitying. I had known some to set their sights on one who would not love them in return, even while rejecting as undesirable another love offered to them freely. The unrequited were not infrequently driven by misery to renounce their original passion and seek one they had formerly despised, only to discover it now beyond reach. Those who refused to elect someone novel were just as susceptible to unhappiness. They were the ones who waited for love to find them and, at first sight of its approach, threw the door open and ran out to meet it, taking up a position by the side of the road with their arms outstretched to embrace the long-awaited gift. There followed utter bafflement when the nearly beloved turned and fled, terrified by so much ardor. After years of unanswered longing, they fell into melancholy, finally losing even the love they felt for themselves. All these people, without exception, thought that love was their right, and none understood, except on rare fleeting occasions, why they could never obtain it. Everything comes down to this. The reason for every word I have written and every word I will write. I am recounting my life for you so that you may know this secret without the pain of discovering it. We are unhappy because we think that love is something we require from someone else. Our salvation depends on a simple gesture that is nonetheless the most difficult act we can perform. We must give away the thing we most long for. Not to receive, but to give. So do we conjure triumph from defeat. This is the lesson of the life forced upon me by my imperfection.
Of course, in the story that you've told, you have developed her character pretty thoroughly. Casanova is the one that we thought we knew. Do you feel as though you got to know Casanova better through writing about him through Lucia's eyes?
I think he's very sympathetic, even though he may have hurt. He himself says in his memoirs that there are only two women he has ever hurt in his life, and Lucia is one of them. So I think he understood finally what he put her through and what a harsh life she must have had. I think he's a very sympathetic character, and he has had his 10,000 pages. I mean, they're wonderful to read, understand me. He's not just the womanizer as we remember him. He's also a philosopher and a rogue, and they're wonderful stories to read. But about love, I do think that, strangely enough, he might still have had a few things to learn. And I think what Lucia teaches him and teaches us is what lacks in his own memoirs.
Arthur Japin is the author of the historical novel In Lucia's Eyes. The erotic novel Story of O created both scandal and sensation when it was published in France in 1954. The book was published under the pseudonym Pauline Reage. Story of O told the sadomasochistic tale of a woman called O and her willing journey into bondage at a chateau for her lover's pleasure. The subject matter can be seen as difficult and obscene, but in 1955, Story of O won the French literary prize Prix des Deux Magots for its haunting narrative. The book sells thousands of copies today, with no publicity, and has sold millions over the years. Filmmaker Paula Rappaport was fascinated with the book and its author. She set out to tell the story of the real woman behind the writing of Story of O. She told Steve Paulson about the first time she read it.
Oh, it was horrifying. And a turn-on, and a whole bunch of things that I had never experienced before. I didn't read the whole thing. I think I must have read the beginning, because the beginning really burned a hole in my memory.
This is basically a story of sadomasochism, or at least of S&M fantasies.
Seems that way, doesn't it? How else could one characterize it? I don't know. It has a lot of that in it. I don't know if she ever used that term, sadomasochistic, but certainly it can be referred to that way.
So this is really a story of this woman who submits totally to what the men want her to do.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? I wonder why she did that. I don't know. The film tries to go into some understanding of what the author was getting at with this sort of odd view of relations between the sexes. It's still a little weird to be the maker of a film about it because it is so dreadful in certain ways, that notion of a woman submitting to these outrageously cruel fantasies on the part of men. But there's something about that book, I must say, it's very curious, that book, because it has a very strong sense of personal freedom in it that really is arrived at through this complete giving over of oneself and through this sort of sexual debasement. It's very paradoxical.
She was no longer wearing either a collar or leather bracelets, and she was alone, her own sole spectator. And yet never had she felt herself more totally committed to a will which was not her own, more totally a slave, and more content to be so.
Because you would think it would be just the opposite of that. You would think it would be enslavement of some sort. It is, but yet it's also just the opposite.
Yeah, I think the final result is the opposite. Not everyone sees the book that way, of course, but that was the sense that I got. And then when I started looking into it, when I found out about the revelation of the secret of author, I thought it was fascinating. And then I started researching much more about the book, and I started to find out that there were many, many other readers who had a similar sense of this book. I mean, why should this book that has that view of this central female character be seen by so many people as a work of feminist literature? Isn't that paradoxical? And then when I met the publisher, a really fascinating man in France, Jean-Jacques Pauvert, he told me that when it was put out in the 50s and then in the 60s, the main audience for the book was women, that women in particular liked this book and men were very frightened by it or turned off by it, probably because of fear.
Now, there's a fascinating story behind this book. It came out in the mid-50s, in 1954. Clearly, the name of the author on the book was not the real name. There was a mystery author here. No one knew exactly who this was. And apparently, there was a lot of speculation that it must have been a man who wrote it. No, a lot of people just simply could not believe that a woman would write the story.
Yeah. I think that Pauvert is very, very smart, the guy who published it in France. And he was very young at the time. And he knew that it was a woman, or he believed that it was a woman in any case. And he continuously fought this battle, even with like enormous names in literature like Camus, for example, could not believe that it could have been written by a woman. I mean, you have to imagine that there was very, very little erotic literature even available written by women at the time. The fact that it had this extremely elegant writing. I mean, I don't know why people didn't just think, well, this was somebody named Pauline Réage, but I guess the way it was promoted, people knew that, at least they knew that Pauline Réage was a pseudonym. So then the speculation began. And, you know, the French literary community, I guess, was pretty tight at the time. And everyone assumed, like, well, if we've never heard of Pauline Réage before, then it must be someone else. And it was, in fact, obviously, someone under the name of Pauline Réage. But I think it helped in the sort of cachet of this book that there was this argument. Could something like this that seems so anti-female possibly be written by a woman? How could a woman reveal these fantasies? And it was unique in that way at that time. I think it was very groundbreaking.
O recalled the prisoners she'd seen in engravings and in history books, who also had been chained and whipped many years ago, centuries ago. If torture was the price she had to pay to keep her lover's love, then she only hoped he was pleased that she had endured it. All soft and silent, she waited. Waited for them to bring her back to him.
But then the other surprising thing about the story is that no one knew, at least publicly, it was not revealed who the author was for decades after the book came out. And then finally, many years later, the truth finally came out. Mm. Her name is Dominique Ory.
She's purported to be Dominique Ory, although even that is a pseudonym.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that.
Many, many levels of identity in this person. So the so-called writer Dominique Ory wrote this novel and put it out under the name Pauline Réage. And she said that at the time she couldn't scandalize her family. Her father was an academic. And he had a very, very racy sense of literature. And in fact, it was in his library that she used to steal books and read at a very early age erotic literature herself, and where she got turned on to it. So she decided to keep her identity secret.
So why did she write that book, Story of O?
Well, she was having this secret love affair with her boss, Jean Paulhan.
Who was married.
He was married, twice married, once divorced. And in the second marriage, his wife was an invalid. I think she was ill with Parkinson's disease, and he had already divorced his first wife. I think when he started up this love affair with Dominique Ory, his wife was already bedridden, and curiously enough, the wife outlived Paulhan. She lived a very long time, many decades in that condition. But, you know, the style in France is for men who are highly placed in society to have mistresses, and they both had this taste for the clandestine, and so they started up this love affair. And so Paulhan obviously loved many aspects of literature, but one thing he really loved was a good erotic book. And his daughter-in-law told me that he had this safe in the house, or locked shelf at least, where he would keep some of his more racy pornography and erotic literature. Dominique knew this, Dominique Ory, his sweetheart. And my sense of him was that he was not the most feminist guy. And one day, Dominique Ory said to him, "Do you know, I think I could write the type of literature that you like, erotic literature." And he answered pretty skeptically, "Oh, really? Do you think you could write it?" And she didn't continue the conversation. What she did was go home and start writing.
One evening, this girl, instead of taking a book to read before she fell asleep, lying on her left side with her feet tucked up under her, a soft black pencil in her right hand, began to write the story she had promised. Beneath the little lamp still lighted at the head of the bed, the hand holding the pencil raced over the paper without the least concern for the hour or the light. The girl was writing the way you speak in the dark to the person you love, when you've held back the words of love too long and they flow at last. For the first time in her life, she was writing without hesitation, without stopping, rewriting, or discarding. She was writing the way one breathes, the way one dreams.
All of these fantasies of her adolescent years just poured forth onto the page, and she describes this, what I would call a white night, where she stayed up all night writing without making any sort of editing, no crossouts, no changes. She just let it pour forth, and she wrote the beginning of Story of O, and she never changed a word. She was very hesitant about giving it to him. She waited a day. She thought about it. And I think on the second day, she brought him this chapter, and she was really pretty petrified because she didn't know if he would laugh at her and find it ridiculous and absurd and embarrassing. And he thought it was the greatest thing he'd ever seen. He just said, "This is amazing." He was very turned on by it. And he said, "You must write more." So that summer, it must have been the beginning of summer when this started, because she would bring him chapters, and it took her a while to write it. Not very long, actually. But, you know, in France in the summertime, everybody goes away for a good month. So this last part of it was written while they were both away on holiday, and she never told a soul about it, only him. And she would send him chapters by mail. She wouldn't keep a copy. And it was must have been this incredibly liberating experience for her, because she was very, very experienced as an editor. And the way she describes this kind of pouring out of the book, it was the first time in her life that she had ever written in that way, this almost automatic writing. Over the course of the summer, she sent him the rest of the book. And finally, they met back in the fall, and the work was completed. And it It has a very strange ending, too. Like, it has a very strange beginning and a strange title. But anyway, it was... I think she would have been satisfied if it had ended after that first chapter in the chateau. But with Paulin's encouragement, she kept writing, and she sort of had to find further and further lengths to go to build the drama, and she managed to succeed at that admirably.
Dominique Ory has a fascinating comment about the underlying impulse in her novel Story of O, and the whole business of submitting to someone else's authority. And she makes this connection to religion. She said, you know, there's a direct connection between what she was doing in this erotic novel and what very religious people do when they submit to God.
Mm. It's a very interesting connection she makes, which is, I wonder whether that will be seen as blasphemous. She compares this total giving over of the self in the behavior of O, the character, exactly, with what extremely religious people do in their devotion to God. It's almost like a desire for the giving up of the self. I think she pursues that to an extreme degree in the writing of that character of O in the book.
O was happy that Renee had had her whipped and had prostituted her, because her impassioned submission would furnish her lover with the proof that she belonged to him, but also because the pain and the shame of the lash and the outrage inflicted upon her by those who compelled her to pleasure when they took her, and at the same time delighted in their own without paying the slightest heed to hers, seemed to her the very redemption of her sins.
Paula Rappaport is the director of the film Writer of O. She talked with Steve Paulson. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. This program was produced by Veronica Rickert, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Anne Strainchamps, and Doug Gordon. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. Kirill Owen is our technical director. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Sex, Love, and Audio Tape, number 212B. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email at ttbook.org. We always love to hear from you.
PRI, Public Radio International.